Welcome one and all. Same thing, just appearing different. This is the Type 1 Radio Lounge Walpurgis Night Special. Welcoming first to your left, or perhaps your right, depending how you're facing your device, Sonic in Brighton, UK. Sonic.
Good evening, sir.
Thank you, sir. Calling this Swami, sir, is like putting an elevator in an outhouse. Just no need for that. And then, now we can call him, sir. From Sligo, Ireland. You know him, you love him, you can't live without him. The man who wrote the book on Walpurgis Night, Thomas Sheridan.
Hello, Nick. Hello, Swami. It's great to be back. I feel like a traveler on the old Silk Road, and you guys are like an ashram or a village or a kibbutz or an oasis. That's always a safe place to land.
Well, thank you ever so much for accepting this Swami's invitation to be here on Walpurgis Night. I mean, this is synchronistic, if nothing else. So,
yes, very much
Thomas.
So.
Thomas, what is new and interesting in Sligo, Ireland?
What's new and interesting here? Well, actually, it's always kind of interesting here. There's always, this is a very ancient part of the world, and we're on the very end of the Western seaboard. And in the last 2 years, I've been quietly coming out of the closet that I actually believe that Atlantis, the myth or the whatever Atlantis was based on, was the UK, Ireland, and an area now sunk under the North Sea called Doggerland, extending down into Iberia, and this was the Atlantean civilization, and that's who built all the megaliths, and that's where all that happened. It was flooded, I believe, in 2500 BC for some reason. I don't know the reason why, but it explains why only Western Europe has these particular types of stone megalith structures, and why there are certain linguistic interesting anomalies, and why I'm going to prove that the East, I've got a book coming out soon called The Druid Code, why the East to West migration thing must be seriously questioned. I believe that it was a West to East migration, and that's what I've been busy doing that, and I think there's been there's a lot of evidence out there that's never been gathered before, mainly because people don't know things like the Irish language like I do. So in terms of this stuff, and I could find linguistic anomalies that I could apply to, say, language in Iberia to show that these were basically all the same culture. And that's not even going with the megalithic stuff mythology, as you know, I cover that. I talk about this an awful lot over the years. But mythology is the key to the human race's real history, because mythology represents the experience of the subconscious mind through history. And the subconscious never, ever lies. It never lies to you. And we can dig back very deep into the human past. Now, we know that the Vedas in India have a record at least going back 10,000 years, and the oral tradition of passing that on proved when these documents were found, especially in the 1940s after Indian independence, that word for word, stories like the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata were perfectly remembered through the oral tradition for perhaps 10,000 years. Well, Ireland is very unique in Europe in that we have a mythology, because we were never conquered by the Romans. And I do believe we had druids that infiltrated the early church in Ireland. We've actually saved our mythology. So there's an awful, we have a Ireland is very unique and has a mythology that goes back as long as the Indian mythology. The stories are always the same. There was incredible floods. There's always stories of people under the water, lost lands beyond the sea. And mythology was a way of passing on delicate information from generation to generation without frightening people, for the reason being that these events may have been secular. The one that happened in 2500 BC was probably preceded by a similar event that happened about 9,000 years ago. And you look at books like Bruno Bettelheim's The Uses of Enchantment, and he shows how fairy tales, European folk tales, they're really about teaching your children about the dangers of pedophiles and rapists, but they can't, human beings are remarkable creatures, that they can't actually make a story that says the world is full of pedophiles or the world is full of rapists. So what they do is they create Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, and that was restored in the repository of the subconscious. Well, the same thing in mythology. These stories were retained deep inside because you couldn't tell people that every so many thousand years a giant wave comes along or whatever, a light appears in the sky and it causes earthquakes, and because people would go mad, they'd never be able to plan for the future. So by putting into allegory, it's held within the subconscious mind as an almost a survival mechanism. Now the University of the new University of Lisbon and Durham University in England recently released a remarkable research paper showing that many of the folk tales and fairy tales that we know, like Jack and the Beanstalk, go back literally to the Bronze Age. They are absolutely ancient, the stories. Now, I'm talking about the actual allegory, the actual specific allegories in them. There's one story called The Smith and the Fairy, or The Smith and the Djinn, or The Smith and the Dwarf, wherever you come from. That's in told, right. The same story is told from Scandinavia to Germany to the Middle East, and yet that's been shown to be ancient. They use this thing, they use a thing called polygenetics to actually use the same algorithms that they use to study the history of botany, that they applied it towards mythology. And they've discovered now, this team in Lisbon and in Durham in England, that these stories are ancient. So this is what my current project is at the moment. This is what interrupted Valpurgis Night Volume 2. And also there was a bit of a tragic story there. There was a gentleman in Germany who had a load of information from me. His father used to work. He was basically the Third Reich's audio engineer. And sadly, this man died. And that's why I didn't put out Valpurgis Night Volume 2 as soon as I wanted to. I don't want to just shove an old book out there that has the same old facts in it. It has to be, you know, new stuff, interesting stuff, not you know, recycling the same old stuff. So it's still, I've got about 70% of that book, Valpurgis Night, written. Assembled, but I don't have the, should we say, the fairy tale, the narrative to stick it together, because I like to write, as you know, in a conversational kind of page-turning style. That was the reason I did Valpurgis Night 1 to begin with, because all the books on the Nazis and the cult out there, they're pretty bad. They're pretty badly written. They're very boring and they're very heavy, or else they deal with silly subjects like aliens and UFOs and stuff. That there's really no evidence for any of that stuff. And so I have a new idea. I have a new contact in Eastern Europe. And so that's going to be after this book, The Druid Code, comes out at the end of the summer, or maybe earlier, then Valpurgis Night 2 comes out after that. So that's basically what I've been doing. Also, I've been chasing a serial killer around Manchester, as you do. Mm-hmm. And I got a huge spread in the Daily Mirror. Millions and millions of people now know about my work. It's gone very mainstream for me, and so the velocity now is still going strong. I still broadcast. Now I do it directly to YouTube now because I don't have time to do any fixed time, so I have to record it in advance and throw it up on YouTube on a timer. But and that's it. And I'm in England in 2 weeks' time to speak at AV7. It's somewhere near Milton Keynes this year.
Great.
And
so AV6 was not your final. That's
No. It's like the Mafia. It's like that movie, The Godfather 3, Al Pacino. Every time I try to pull out, people. So it's like being in a mafia. I think I've accidentally signed a blood oath or something there. But it's a fantastic festival. I just love going that. Just to meet the people. There's just so many nice people go to that event. It's a better.
What have you got? You're going to be speaking about there?
It's kind of going to be a spooky one this year. We could talk about this tonight as well, go into it, but later on if you have any questions. Basically, it's going to be, look, we're facing transhumanism now, right? This is the psychopath's main thing. They've got us in every other way. They've conquered culture. They've conquered social orders. They've conquered cult society, sociology, everything, living, cult, everywhere we live. They've conquered religion. The ultimate thing now would be to bring us to a kind of an end game of basically switching off our humanity and turning us into machines, because the psychopaths themselves, the only thing they've never been able to control is our humanity. And they've done everything from the Prussian education system to public relations and marketing to turn us like them, robots, mindless robots. And they've used medications and everything. They're going to go for broke.
Do you think that the promotion of trans is a way of very, very subtly filtering in the transhumanist movement? You know, like people.
Oh, you mean transgender and stuff?
Yeah, transgender. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the way that that's been hooked onto the end of the LGBT movement, it's sort of LGBT now.
What they've done is they've given gays and lesbians freedom. So the only reason they did that was because they could eventually hook transgender onto that.
Yeah.
And also legal and that getting the transgender onto that. So basically, they freed gays and lesbians, gave them the same quality of life as everyone else, and then said, okay, you also have this as well. And this is the same reason why they have things like genderless children's in school now, where they don't call themselves boy or girl, they name each other as friend.
Well,
you see, this is one step closer to the machine,
here
to the blob.
Here in Brighton, they've just announced like all the primary school places, so all the parents know where the kids are going, and it only in Brighton has a questionnaire been sent out to these prospective parents asking them what does their preschool child what gender they identify with in order to.
Whoa. That's well out of order.
Yeah, yeah.
How can it?
Last year, they sent out a questionnaire to, like, I think it was like high schools in the area, with 23 types of identification for basically being a boy or a girl. 23.
Holy moly!
And then now. They're directing it at preschool children. What the fuck is that about? So with people like Miley Cyrus, who has sort of morphed into this androgynous character, who heavily influences these young minds to question their body. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's too young now. It's okay, when we were growing up, we had Bowie, we had Freddie Mercury, we had Boy George, and all that stuff. But that was you didn't get into that stuff until you were like late teens, early 20s, until you were like at least 16, 15, 16.
Yeah.
Now it's like 8 and 9 year olds. And, when we were growing up, the choice was things like, Sex Pistols, Clash, Blur, Oasis, Small Stones, Beatles. You know what I'm saying? Like, they were like those kind of cultural choices.
Yeah.
They were, but now their choices are being foisted upon their actual biology. They want the blob. You can't get transhumanism until you have the blob, and the blob is just the meat golem, as I call him, the meat golem. It's just basically a soulless, vacuous bot made of flesh, and they need that. They need that, and this is a part of it. This is a big part of it.
Yeah. Very dangerous.
Well, it's very obvious. It's very obvious to this Swami and within the Swami's oral tradition, which the Swami represents in the West, that we are in what within the Indian cosmology is referred to as the Kali Yuga, which is a period of time where if you were to look at the face of a clock, we're basically at the bottom of the hour. This is the time when the circumstances on the planet favor and uplift the corrupt, the evil, all of that. And this is their time. But that does not mean that individuated units of consciousness existent within this time cannot recognize their own connection to divinity, their own oneness with all that is, and their own creative power.
In the Irish mythology, there's and the idea of something called, it's called a somnath. And a somnath is like the unmanifest being, the truth at the center of all consciousness. And this somnath is the repository of memories going back through the past. And its purpose today, and it was the reason why it was actually entered into the Irish mythological canon, was to remind Irish people of a time before Christianity came along, when the old gods existed and so on. Now, this is common in all kinds of things. Now, I'm a big fan of the Kali archetype. I am a big fan of it. I like the destructive nature of Kali, just like I liked it. I like the Kali has the same purity as Lucifer. Lucifer is no bullshit. You know, there's no bullshit in Lucifer. He's the archetype of the absolute pure truth, and so is Kali. Kali is the absolute pure truth of the Vedic archetype, and I'm a big fan of these. In fact, it's interesting that we're doing this on Valpurgis Night, because if you think, like, tonight's Valpurgis Night, or before it was called Valpurgis Night, it was called Hexan Night, which means witchcraft night or magic night, and tomorrow is Beltane, so that we have it's the spring equinox. So we're right now in the duality of it. We're in the shadow tonight of Valpurgis Night, where all the bullshit is convulsed and bubbled up from the subconscious, from the society, everything. And then tomorrow it's burnt in a sacrifice. It's burnt. So you see, one of the things I don't like about the Kali Yuga idea, although I'm not saying it's wrong, is that it gives a fatalistic idea that, oh, well, the world's always going to be crap until, well, it's not over for another couple of hundred years or something. But I know also within the Vedic tradition that the attitude is, like, just because consciousness is in a shithole right now doesn't mean that you as the individual have to be, which is the same kind of idea as the somnath in the Irish mythological tradition. It's a very powerful message. It doesn't get enough outlet out there. So that's how I feel. It's every day on multiple levels, Kali will hack my head off. You know what I'm saying? Hakata, the dead queen of the West, will strip the flesh from my bones. But later on in the day, I'll be reborn in another way. It's like this is constant internal construction and reconstruction at the archetypal and spiritual level. Very just as our cells are constantly manifesting. And so, I'm big into that. You see, one of the things with Crowley was, when Alistair Crowley said, he was absolutely right when he said the age of Horus. He was ushering in the age of Horus. He was creating the 20th century. We know the 20th century is especially culturally anyway, the 20th century is a product of Aleister Crowley. Absolutely no doubt about it. He came to pull, you know, pull Christ off the cross and replace it with the idea of free love, sex, drug, heathenism, and we've got that. But the Aeon of Horus is collapsing because it simply did not take into effect technology. He didn't know about it, and technology is killing it. It's killing the Aeon of Horus. We're in a very unnatural part, like I said, at the bottom of the hour, but we're also on a very unnatural path at the bottom of the hour. It's not like we've had it in previous generations. So I'm really looking forward. I know this sounds weird, but I know basically, when people say to me, is the future, how is the future? I say it's fucked. It's bleak. It's bleak if you play the game.
If you jump out
as a passive observer and then live your own life, implement your own sort of, see yourself as understanding these cycles, but you're not in them as such directly.
Like, and in the world, find that
your life is very rewarding.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes,
and your life is very rewarding. Very rewarding. And so, people say to me, what's the hope for the future? And I say, there isn't any. Look around you. The world is falling to bits. Like the children trans. But that doesn't mean you have to go down with the Titanic either. And that's my attitude. And it's the truth. And it works.
And even from the point of view and understanding of this Swami, who represents an ancient oral tradition handed down from guru to disciple through time, where the disciple ends up becoming guru and then helping.
And that's important, because if you don't know where you're coming from, you don't know where you're going. It doesn't matter if it's your tradition, my tradition, whatever Nick's tradition is, or anyone. It's very important to know what the ancestors went through. And I'm talking about the ancestors, I'm talking about the ancient ancestors, but also the ones in the past, because you're reminded that no matter what's been thrown at us in the past, the empires, the wars, the crusades, the slaughter of our ancestors, we're still here. The bastards haven't wiped us out. The psychopaths may have controlled the planet at the top, but the psychopaths don't control us the way they want to. Human beings have an enormous resolve for this. And the reason why this is because, like your tradition, Swami, and even like my Irish tradition, the roots go deep. And the tree with the deepest roots is the hardest to blow over.
And
we have to get into that.
It says a lot about the true human spirit, that it cannot be wavered at all, no matter how much perceived oppression is upon it. The flicker of the human spirit prevails every time.
Absolutely. You look at in the north of England was genocided by William the Conqueror with the harrying of the north. After he conquered England, they starved and murdered just about every English person in the north of England in order to replace them with Anglo-Normans, these French invaders who were actually originally Vikings who became Christians. So they brought the Christian infection to England. But the population of the north of England was wiped out, ethnically cleansed, wiped out. The very first victims of the British Empire were the English. They were first the indigenous English. However, even with that, here we are 1,000 years later, 900 to 1,000 years later, people are still going to Stonehenge, they're still going to Avebury, they're still aware that these places have connections to them and their ancestry, and that is unbroken. And though I can tell you, that's why we must protect these megalithic and ancient sites, because otherwise, if they could get away with it, they would have bulldozed Stonehenge down a long time ago and buried it under the ground. Because as long as those stones exist and places like Newgrange in Ireland, what they are beacons of hope. That's what they are. They're beacons that fire. And it's all over the world, all our indigenous traditions, those beacons fire a light at our subconscious. And they say to us, remember who you are. Remember where you came from. And they cannot stop that right now. And that's why they try to own all these locations and all these sites and put theme parks around them and everything. Because that there's a fear in that, and they're afraid of mythology, and they're afraid of ancient traditions, because I'm now at this stage in my life realizing how incredibly powerful that stuff is, and it is the silver bullet we've been waiting for. It doesn't matter if Miley Cyrus and Lady Gaga and all the rest of these types, these freaks, and it's not their fault because they're victims too, are pushed out there and pushed in our faces. Once that spirit, that ancient, as you said, that uncrushable spirit remains, we're okay. And that's why if the future is bleak, the ones who will remember who they're meant to be will be fine. The masses who go along with the bullshit, you know, c'est la vie.
Yeah, definitely. I can't agree with you more there, Thomas.
Yeah. There's going to be no great way to go.
They have made a choice to follow a dead-end road, and they must face up to the result of their choice. But for those of us who focus on even the glimmer of a dying ember of consciousness itself, we will get to see more and more and more. Though there are few of us, it is enough to keep the memory and the remembrance and the revival potent. And that's all it takes.
I think the people who've woken up, say that we talk about like people have woken up, the ones who've woken up properly, and they aren't like, you know, obsessed at reading about pedophilia stories 24/7 and are that kind of going over 9/11 to the end of time. I think the ones who've woken up properly and they've gone through all that and they come out the other side saying, no, there has to be something bigger to all this. We're sort of like the druids now. We are the druids. It's our job through our websites, through our books, through our teachings to bring that story forward to the next generation and to keep saving it, because that's our job now. Our job is to be like those druids. That's what the druids were about, really. In fact, and that's what we are.
Keep and bring people to the conversation. Keep that conversation alive, because the oral tradition is really the only thing that we have. Everything else can be burnt, but the oral tradition will always remain.
Yeah, the Romans tried it. They did their best with everything their fire could do, and they did not extinguish knowledge.
Well, here's a classic example. People say, well, where's the hope? Show me the glimmering hope. And you just said fire. Kindle flopped. Kindle was supposed to by now have replaced every paperback book. There was supposed to be no more bookstores, no more hard copy books. Everything was to be on the Kindle. Bookshops are coming back. There's more paper, real books being printed now than ever. And just like the vinyls, new generations have discovered, they instinctively know what's real and what's bullshit. And Kindle sales and reader sales have flopped for that reason. And that was an awful fright for them.
I think, actual book sales have overpassed e-books now, haven't they? The tide has turned.
And bookshops they said that bookshops would only be a handful of collectible, and even all the big chains like Barnes and Nobles and in America and Books Binders and in England, what's the big chain?
Waterstones.
They're even opening new branches all over the place.
Yeah.
That was a real victory against the dark forces.
So do you think that the same thing will happen, there is a resurgence of vinyl. You go into HMV now and they've got a massive vinyl collection, even though the vinyl as sort of a fiver at least has been added to the cost, maybe because going back to pressing vinyl, the vinyl plants have said, right, well, you can fucking pay for this now. You fucked us off like 10, 15 years ago, so now here's payback. And fair play. But
there's also carbon levies on the plastic and stuff like that. So that's passed on to the consumer. But however, it doesn't matter. I was in Terra Records in Dublin last week, and it was like the 1980s again, the amount of the vinyl on sale.
But they could completely bypass the carbon tax there by making the vinyls out of hemp.
Yeah, but that's never going to happen, because then people are going to say, well, then make everything out of hemp, and then they'll say, fuck you. Their oil is their magic, you know? Their oil is their main
goo.
Weapon of sorcery. Is
it's the black goo.
Their main weapon of sorcery is oil. Oil. God. Gold, oil, and diamonds. That's what they've always been about.
Yeah.
Gold, oil, and diamonds. And oil is their elixir to spellbind us all. This is the potion they use. The magic potion they've used is oil. I mean, I was talking to a friend from Lebanon today, and we're just saying that, like, if there was no oil if oil wasn't used, there'd be no problems in the Middle East. The only reason there's wars in the Middle East is because those people are unfortunately standing upon oil. If that oil was not used, if that oil was no longer used, the Middle East would be fine tomorrow.
Yeah.
It'd be back to the way it was the 1920s, where everybody, all the Jews, the Muslims, and the Druze, and the Christians, and they all lived side by side in peace. Doing business, there was no problems.
So do you think that they're using it as like a spellbinding agent, that has something to do with the fact that it is just full of life force? It is like dead animals and plants. So the life force that, you know, was imbued in those beings is now imbued in the oil. And that's where maybe the energy comes from to power.
One takes that petroleum oil is abiotic, and the earth produces it.
But even if it's abiotic, it's still the same. What Nick said, that still applies.
Right.
Well, and
who can't accept the. You know, it's only dead things. You know, the earth creates this, period.
Yeah.
However the mechanism, it does.
Exactly. Let me segue that into something else, but it's the same kind of idea. What Nick was saying and what you were saying about, if there's a either way, there's a biological component to oil, no matter if it's abiotic or it's like, you know, fossil fuel. There's still a biological. That agent, that's a great word that Nick just used to describe it. That agent, the spellbinding agent. What that has done is it's created. You look at like the Rockefellers, right? And the people in charge of all these Texas oil companies, big oil. The CEOs of big oil, including the Bushes, right? What they basically are oil golems, right? Their power, their strength, their danger. Is constituted in a kind of a consciousness of oil solidified within these psychopaths. Now, when Rabbi Lowe created the golem in Prague, he took soil from the river because it had all the living elements in it, then brought it to life by performing a ritual involving two of his people going one way around the golem and one way around the other until a spirit was brought into it. And that's exactly what when I look at, like, you know, David Rockefeller, or I look at George Bush Senior in particular, what I see is a petroleum golem or an oil golem. They are the expression, the living, should we say, existing expression of oil in a kind of a human shape. And those animals in Saudi Arabia, those sheikhs in those oil families there, they're all the same as well. They're not human beings. They're oil golems, petroleum golems, or oil golems. And this is – so, like, when we try to apply a human consciousness to these people, these creatures, right, it's never going to work. It's never going to work. Just like, you know, when the golem went on the rampage in Prague, they couldn't – only one person could bring the golem down, and that was the guy who created Rabbi Lau. And that's what he did. Now, the only thing that can actually – bring down these oil, these petroleum golems like the Bushes and the Rockefellers is the same thing. is but that to not use the oil anymore, not to breathe the life into it. And that's why it's not sorry, it's big oil is not only the money, but it's also these oil golems being kept alive by it. And if we move to hemp or to renewable energies, what we're doing is we're switching off these oil golems, and they're fighting for life.
And
it's all, the exact it's, same result one gets as an individuated unit of consciousness if you are in somehow involved with a psychopathic human or otherwise. Thomas's teaching, no contact ever again. The very same can be applied on a larger scale to those who would try to addict you to what they provide.
Yeah. Like, there's loads of ways, you know, like, so many people are waiting for a great awakening or a revolution, and these like oil golems at the top, they want the meat golems at the bottom to always think about that, to always think, well, one day there's going to be a big sea change, a rapture, and you know, a great awakening, and that will solve everything. But that takes away those individual pieces of people proactively doing things in their own lives, you know, right, instead right. of. Instead of, you know, like little tiny things. I mean, today at work, we were talking about how we don't like to use the vacuum cleaner anymore on the carpet, but we now use the vacuum sweep, the carpet sweeper, you know, the old-fashioned sweepers that two little spinning brushes inside it. And actually find that therapeutic and much more likable. To do like than actually going around bending over with a vacuum cleaner. It doesn't have the noise. We're using no electricity. We're just using our biological energy to do it. And as a joke, I was just saying it feels better. That little things like that, you know, take back your power. That's no contact ever again as well. So the feckin' utility company is basically a dealer for the oil companies or the coal companies. You've just cut off a supply from in one little thing like that. And that's how you do it.
And it's one thing stacked upon another thing, coordinated with another thing. One individual unit of consciousness at a time that brings about this big change that unfortunately so many expect to just be handed to them with no work, no thought, and no effort.
Oh, yeah. That's a waiting for a great awakening is the pussy's option.
Well,
be a fucking man or be a woman and do it yourself.
People, until they sort of get a hang of the reality of the situation that we live in on the planet, to a slight degree, then the bonds of that Stockholm syndrome slowly ebbs away. You know, that's faith in the monetary system or politicians or oil barons who really
or the contemporary supply chains.
If we stop giving them attention, then and like you said earlier, Thomas, start living your own life and being true to yourself rather than waiting for, because waiting is like a victim mentality, isn't it? So
it's fear.
Yeah, it's like Tom Petty's song, "The Waiting is the Hardest Part." It's true. That's for everything fear. In life.
And yeah, which leads to the fear. Waiting. Yeah, and then whatever news media is being bombarded at you, you know, whether you're walking down the, you know, in the supermarket or, you know, in a pub, or just on the street, you know, with billboards, that's just compounding people's fear of in the world or in themselves. And it's all all trying to distract people from realizing that they're the ones with the power.
It's the only effective means of distraction. If someone walks in a room and tells you, you must eat an elephant, well, immediately you will freeze at the enormity of the task and doubt the ability to get through it. But if you take one bite at a time, process it, chew it, swallow it, you will be done eventually.
Do they impose some sort of time limit? You know, I mean, I suppose you could technically get through an elephant if you had enough time. But if you're saying in one sitting, then that'd be...
Well, then you just sit there and chew. And you'll get it done eventually. See, with especially amongst people who have no concept yet, because they have not experienced anything outside the time-space continuum, because they do not meditate, they do not study, they do not seek that. This is not attractive to them. Okay, great. Don't be attracted to that. And what you are attracted to will give its own results. If you are attracted to the concept of there is more than my mind can understand or my mind can create, you then get admitted into that which is greater than and within which all of this is happening.
Yeah, anxiety is the shadow not being faced. Anxiety is almost like the rumbles of you burying the shadow, burying the stuff you should be taking care of. And you all know what happens with a volcano. It'll explode. People would rather wait for the volcano to explode or blow them to bits than deal with the bullshit piecemeal. If there's a problem to be solved, immediately solve it, either by walking away from it or confronting the matter. But one way or another, just do it. Because if you don't do it, and you push it into your subconscious, it will become a psychic time bomb.
So, getting back to the megalithic structures, you've been visiting quite a few of late. Is that true?
Yeah. I've been doing a lot around Ireland as well. But I've made friends with this guy, a kind of a legend here in Ireland by the name of Jack Roberts. This is a guy who was like sleeping in Newgrange late all night long back in the 70s to see which stars would appear over over certain openings at certain times, as well as studying the rock art. And his books and a guy called Martin Brennan, who he worked with back then, have been a huge influence to me of late and changed my whole attitude towards these buildings. These buildings are They're art galleries that capture starlight and the cosmos, and they're not where people were sent to be buried or where individuals go to die, but they were where the forces of the cosmos went to be held, almost as a museum of types, a museum of the human experience and the museum of the universe. Now, let me give you an amazing story. In 1699, you know, you've heard of Newgrange in Ireland. Newgrange is like Ireland's Stonehenge. And on the winter solstice, the sun rises through the opening and illuminates the entire inner chamber, something they only allow the elites to see now. But In 1699, centuries, probably a couple of thousand years after Newgrange was last used by Neolithic people, the local landlord was cleaning out stones. He was finding these stones, and they were using them for road building. And workers uncovered the famous entrance stone to Newgrange, the one with all the spirals on it, and then opened up the passage to him. Now, this guy was convinced that the Vikings had built this tomb, because it wasn't very different than some of the mounds you see in Denmark and Sweden that were built by the Greeks and the Norse. And so he immediately sent word out that we found a major archaeological site and this barbarous mound, as he called it. And a guy called Lund, a very famous Welsh antiquarian, came over to Ireland to have a look at it a few months later. And he just started asking the locals about it. And he met this one guy, I think his name is Cormac O'Neill, just a normal countryman. And the countryman told him, oh, no, that's not the Norse who built that. That belonged to an ancient race who lived here called the Tuatha De Danann. And it's the repository. Now, we're talking about thousands of years afterwards. It's the repository of the soul of the god of Angus Og, the Irish god of sexual love and poetry, who was conceived in an affair between the Boan goddess and the Dagda. And your man Lund heard this and couldn't believe what he was hearing. What did this stuff? And then Lund in his notes wrote down, and O'Neill mentioned something about a strange operation that took place in heathen times involving the sun. Now, it was not known that the midwinter sunrise illuminated the chamber until about 1972. So in 1666, a local guy had remembered right back to the most ancient times, not only names of individuals, rituals and races, but also that there was some kind of, that Newgrange was some way connected to the sun. It had survived in folklore for thousands and thousands of years. And it wasn't until the 1880s that all these ancient manuscripts were really deeply looked into by something called the Gaelic League. And they were saying things like, there is this thing, this group called this woman, particularly a woman called Lady Gregory. There is this group called the Tuatha De Danann. There is this entity called the Dagda. There is this entity called the Boan, who's the dismembered goddess of the River Boyne, where Newgrange is. And so it just goes to show you the power that these things can last. These things can go on forever. And when Stonehenge was first, when it was basically accepted in the mid 60s that Stonehenge was some kind of astronomical device, calendar in some way, on some levels, right? That was ridiculed by the academics. Now, the academics also ridiculed the idea that Stonehenge, that Newgrange was some kind of solar temple or something that's until one of them actually fell asleep in it and saw the sun rise. Now, these guys, this guy Jack Roberts I'm talking about, he's done this for years ago, back in the 70s. He was doing this, sleeping in the tombs and watching the stars rise and watching at certain times of year to see what constellation might be in the opening, you know, in the tomb, not the tomb, I keep using that word. You see, that's programming. They're not tombs. They find almost no bodies in them. Near Newgrange, there's a place called Knout. It was opened up in 1967. It has the largest collection of Neolithic rock art probably anywhere in the world. And it was opened in – and this guy called Professor Ewan from – I think it was from UCD and University College Dublin. And his team broke into the thing for the first time in 5,000 years, entered this spectacular Neolithic art gallery of these incredible rock art, went down to the end of the chamber, found a flint mace head, but they called it a mace head. I think it's some kind of ritual object. Most beautiful thing you've ever seen that was carved from flint that only exists in Orkney. So we're talking about 5,000 years ago, there was people from Orkney were traveling to Ireland back and forth, and they didn't have good ships then. It was probably on land. And then after this, no bodies were found, and then he walks out and he declares the place a tomb. because they always associate these things with debt. And that's because it's like Jesuit programming. And so it's becoming more and more apparent to me, especially as I visit these ones around Ireland, that these are far more significant in terms of what they represent. And they're absolutely, now maybe later races who came along may have put bodies in them, but they were not originally built for that purpose. And we have been so lied to and so dicked around. They were for capturing the heavens. Let me put it this way. They could almost be seen as vaginas and the cosmic forces as the male sperm and entering into them and literally fertilizing the earth. And when you think about Stonehenge, right? Now, that's part of Wiltshire of England. That's the breadbasket of England, right? There's fuck all that's surrounded in Neolithic. There's fuck all topsoil there. It's chalk. We're a little skimming of topsoil, and yet that produces all the wheat in vast amounts of wheat and other crops in England. And I'm trying to say, was this some kind of technology that was used to fertilize the land, like a kind of an Orgorn energy type thing? And now I'm not convinced, but I believe that's a real possibility now. These were machines for capturing the forces of the universe in order to improve agriculture and maybe general health and maybe even to raise consciousness of the people around them. Maybe to bring them, to give them the modern brains that we have.
Like a womb. I'm just looking
exactly.
At like a, yeah, exactly.
I'm just looking at pictures of Newgrange now, and that is some structure. That isn't it? It's massive.
Type in Knowth, and what, just you will not believe the artwork on the stones inside it. I mean, these were sublime artists. These people, these were not ignorant cavemen.
Yeah,
right.
Knowth, Knowth.
And people who held this knowledge lived all over the planet.
They used
what was available to them to seed something, as they knew the darkest of times was coming, something that could be looked upon and contemplated by those with the interest that would give them right understanding eventually.
Right. And the idea of the Dagda, the god, the good god, impregnating the Boand goddess at Newgrange and giving birth to Angus Og, the god of sexual love and poetry. What that tells you is talking about human beings becoming something else rather than just creatures of survival and instinct. They become higher aspects of humanity. Poetry, the arts, romance instead of mating, you know, that kind of a thing. The higher aspects of humanity.
It's not purely procreation, it's actually creation at work from the divine perspective.
Is that
beautiful? Yeah, that's
quite synchronistic that place is called Knowth. That's like knowledge. It's like trying to.
I never thought about that. It's like gnosis. I never thought about that, but yeah, it's fascinating. Yes. Yeah.
It just looks like a hobbit village.
Yeah.
All these little mounds. Well, cool.
Yep. But that's the grass has grown over them. In ancient times, the stones underneath would have been exposed to the sun, and they would have shone like beacons on those mountains in the sun. They would have been blinding white beacons that would have been seen from miles and miles away. So they were about capturing light and about emitting light.
Right. Well.
Yes.
We're coming up to the end of this part of the show. But I've got the tune that you requested, Thomas. The B-52 song. For all the listeners that are listening now, when this tune finishes, the play, what you're listening to now, will stop. if you just refresh your player, then you can join us for part two of the show.
Yay!
We'll see you all after this.